Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking human rights and what that actually means. But first of all, I want to point out a couple of changes on the Tortoise Shack. Rachel has left and taken DTP solo. Wish her all the best with her new venture. And I would say to you guys, if you've been listening, you'll find her on the same feeds. You won't miss out. Make sure she's still there. She'll be there every Friday. She's still putting out great content. On the flip side, we're working on a couple of other side projects and wish one person who's still around, who won't go away, he's still on there and I'm looking at you now. Martin, how are you?
Hey, Tony. Not too bad, Tony. Not too bad.
Did we just get you out of bed, did we?
Yeah, it is quite early and at least it's not raining. You know, it's first time in, 40 days it hasn't rained, so... You know, it's a little bit better today.
Listen, we'll jump straight in because I'm conscious this man is very busy. We are delighted to be joined on the line by Brian Killoran from he's the CEO of the Immigrant Council of Ireland. Brian, first of all, thanks very much for taking the time. Appreciate it. It's unprecedented times. You're not in your office. You're working from home. We're all in this new thing. But do you want to just start off first of all and give us an idea of what the Immigrant Council does.
Absolutely, yeah, and thanks for having me on, lads. So the Immigrant Council, so we were set up in 2001, and basically to set up to respond to the fact that Ireland was beginning to become more diverse, you know. 1995 was the first year we had more immigration into Ireland than emigration. So we'd made a change, and things were changing. There was new communities. They had specific needs. So we were set up really to respond to that. And the first need that people had was information and legal advice. They needed to know how to navigate the immigration system and how to access their rights and entitlements. So we started off giving people confidential information. And then in 2006, we became an independent law center. So we give people free legal representation as well, which is brilliant because you can't get that kind of free legal representation for immigration issues generally, you know. So we take cases of people in extreme vulnerability. We give them advice and assistance, and in some cases litigate their case, in some cases go to the High Court. At the moment, we actually have a Supreme Court case going on at the moment as well on family reunification for refugees. So it's kind of that model of trying to change the system through legal representation. And if you take one case, you might have a broader impact on lots of other people as well. We do specific services around victims of human trafficking that I know we're going to talk a bit about this morning, victims of domestic violence and kids in the immigration system, so unaccompanied minors and things like that. And then we do the other side of our house we call integration. So we work on political participation in migrants. We work on diversity and leadership, capacity building, all that kind of stuff. So we try and do a lot. Like, we're a non-governmental organization, so we receive kind of a small bit of indirect state funding, but most of our funding comes from philanthropy and EU projects and lots of other bits and pieces. So there's 17 of us in the place, and service provision, as I say, is the backbone, and then we do everything on top of that and lobby and advocate for change. So we're a small bunch, but we're a noisy bunch, which is good.
I am conscious that you mentioned the human trafficking element. There was a recent report, and it showed that Ireland was actually I'm going to use the word fulcrum. Maybe that's unfair, but it was certainly a key destination in terms of the human trafficking. Can you give me an idea of what would, you know, when we say human trafficking, what does that actually mean in the modern world?
Human trafficking, it's described as the truth, is not hyperbole to call it that. So sometimes people mix up smuggling and trafficking. So in some instances, smuggling is a different thing. So people smuggling is when you will see somebody who's in a very desperate situation, say to trying to get from France into the UK through Calais. That's a situation everybody's familiar with. Somebody will come along and say, okay, if you give me $5,000, I'll get you into the back of a truck. We'll try and get you across to the UK. So that's the kind of a situation where somebody is being exploited because they're in a situation of extreme need and dire circumstances, but they're knowingly, to a certain extent, going into a relationship with somebody who's trying to get them around immigration procedures. Trafficking is different. So what trafficking involves usually is deception. So it usually involves somebody approaching somebody, for example, in Brazil. It's usually a family member. In some instances, it could be like a cousin. It could be a close family friend, somebody who knows the person and says, I know somebody who can get you arrange to get a student visa to go to Ireland. You'll go there, you'll be able to improve your English, be able to work part-time. It'll be brilliant. It'll be all, you know, above board and sorted out and solid. So they go into this thinking that it's a great opportunity for them. But then they go into the process and they find out that it's way different than actually it appeared on the surface. So a lot of the time what will happen is they'll enter the country and then they'll be told by the person that has arranged all this, actually now you owe us a debt. So you owe us 15 grand and you're going to have to do something for that 15 grand to pay it back to us in some way. And that can be in some cases labor exploitation. So you're going to have to go and work in a place and you're going to be in dire conditions in doing so. You're in some cases forced into prostitution to pay back the debt. It's kind of 50-50 in terms of the prevalence of it, sexual exploitation on one side, labor exploitation on the other. There's lots of other different types of trafficking as well as domestic servitude. So you're going to have to work in this house as a carer for kids or as a, essentially a servant. There's organ harvesting, which doesn't so much go on in Ireland, but globally is part of trafficking as well. And basically, it's organized crime. So it's essentially deceiving somebody into a circumstance and then coercing them into paying back this debt that suddenly appeared. And it can involve violence, threats of violence. It can involve essentially incarceration, being kept somewhere against your will. It can involve having your immigration documents taken away from you. So it's exploitation in the highest level, really.
And this stuff is not, how do I put it? It's not some nebulous thing. There's cases of these all happening in Ireland, whether it be through some exploitation of workers or people into the sex trade. I'm right in saying that there was also incidences where people were, women were being trafficked to marry to other people to get visas and things like that as well. The situations have been seen where there's been, you know, I remember in Blanchardstown there was a district court saying there's a high incidence of certain and the police investigating the idea that they were arranging marriages to and these women were being brought in from other countries purely for this on this basis, you know. Can I ask though, when people are trafficked, how typically would you come into contact with some of these cases?
Yeah, so they're not the type of cases that kind of present themselves. Nobody knocks on our door and says, I think I'm a victim of trafficking, because a lot of the time people won't even understand what it means to be trafficked themselves. They don't know necessarily the circumstance that they're in. So a lot of the time the referrals that we will get, so when I talked earlier about the fact that we're a legal service, we take about 200 cases a year. About 50 or 60 of those cases are full legal representation. And then of that, about 20 to 25 cases are victims of trafficking every year. And usually in terms of high court cases, we will usually have about 3 or 4 high court cases, and at least 2 or 3 of those are at high court level as well. So it's a big chunk of the legal work that we do. But basically, it generally comes on referral from somewhere else. So somebody will come in contact with a health service, for example. The HSE have the Women's Health Project that works with women who are in prostitution. They'll spot somebody who they think has indications of being a victim of trafficking, and they'll refer that person into us. It can come from the guards. Sometimes when they come across somebody in a brothel or a situation of being in prostitution that they think is in that circumstance too. So generally, like, one of the things about it is that somebody in that circumstance is in such a position of being controlled and such a position of having been maybe for months or even years told that any services of the state will end up in you being deported, or you'll be arrested, or you'll be, you know, all kinds of bad things will happen to you if you go and report something like this. So there's a huge trust building exercise that has to happen. So usually it's like, it's a long road of building trust and building a relationship with somebody to get them to the point where they'll come to somebody like us and get legal representation and actually then take a case, you know, because you're dealing, like, most of the cases we have are cases of sexual exploitation. Some of them are mixed, where there's a mix of sexual exploitation, domestic servitude, labor exploitation, but the majority are sexual exploitation. And in those instances, you're dealing with somebody who has for many months or maybe years been in a really traumatic situation. They've been in something that was against their will. They had no idea this was happening. They've been terrified by the traffickers into actually doing anything about it. So building that relationship with them is really important, and it takes a long time to do. But once you do, like some of the women that come out the far side of this and they get their circumstances sorted out, they're some of the strongest people you'll ever come across in your life, because they've been through hell. You know, they've been through an absolutely dire circumstance. So it's kind of there's a lot of different ways that these circumstances come to life, but only like at a global level, they reckon about 4%. So it's only, you know, to say the tip of the iceberg is a cliche, but it's true in a lot of instances that it's a really small percentage that actually come to services.
Why has Ireland got such high incidence of this, Brian? What makes us different to the countries that don't have high incidence of this?
I don't think there's anywhere really that doesn't have elements of it happening, you know, and there are definitely countries where it's much more prevalent. You know, in South America, it's rife, you know, between all the different countries in South America, to a much larger extent. I think in Ireland, it's just the very fact that, you know, we're like a modern kind of open state that has an immigration system. And when there is an immigration system, there'll always be elements of organized crime that try and kind of use that immigration system or try and get around it, like in the case of people smuggling as well. So I don't think we're any different in that regard. Like the fact that we're also kind of attached to the UK to a limited extent through things like the common travel area are also appealing for traffickers and for smugglers as well. That sometimes Ireland can be a route into the UK where getting in through other ports into the UK might be more difficult. So you get into Northern Ireland and you can get across to the mainland UK. And that's an element of it as well, as the proximity to the UK. But I don't think we're generally any different from other countries, where it's like, in every country in the world, labor exploitation exists, unfortunately. In every country of the world, there is a sex trade. And in those areas, there will be trafficking as an element of that, you know. I think the thing that we faced in Ireland when we started talking about trafficking back in 2008 was an abject denial from the government and civil servants that it existed in Ireland at all. They were like, no, that doesn't happen here. That's not a thing here. That's something that happens in faraway places and, you know, not in Ireland. But actually the reality then started to become clear to them that it was much different, that it is a reality here. But I think we're still dealing with that institutional delay then of like, nah, it's only a small thing in Ireland. You know, the 7,000 people in direct provision, maybe 100 to 120 of them are victims of trafficking. So it's a small thing within direct provision. And getting the official responses to it then are very difficult, because they'll say, well, you know, we have more pressing concerns. But we would say, like, you know what? Those 100 people have been through traumatic circumstances, and they need a gold standard response that we're not giving them in Ireland. So that report you talked about, Tony, the TIP report, was 2 weeks ago at this stage.
Yeah.
For the last couple of years, Ireland's been downgraded again and again. So we were tier one, which means you're meeting the minimum standards for supporting victims of trafficking. Then in 2018 and 2019, we were downgraded to tier two, which means we're not meeting the minimum standards. And now we're going down to watch the, which essentially means you're barely clinging on to tier three. And if you look at tier three, there's countries like Afghanistan, Syria, essentially failed states. We don't want to be there. We don't want to be a tier two, you know? So it's like, it's a very slow delay in our responding to it. And I think it starts with the premise of, you know, 12 years ago that actually trafficking doesn't happen in Ireland, but it does happen in Ireland, you know? So it's a bit of an uphill climb to try and advocate on this issue. But at the same time, there are solutions, you know, the things we can do in Ireland, because if we're not facing it to the same extent other places face it.
Well, do you want to give us an idea of what you mean by there are solutions? I mean, just anything would give us a bit of hope, because the idea that we're just floating above the likes of failed states is a bit terrifying, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. And like so a lot of people will say, okay, so the US State Department do the TIP report, right? And some of the commentary is, well, what right does the US government, is, you know, putting kids in cages at their southern border? And I think that's a legitimate criticism, because at the same, you know, the US government's immigration policies at the moment are horrendous, especially at their southern border. The thing about the TIP report is that it's a report that predates the Trump administration. So it's been going on for a number of years. And the things that they identify in that and the things that they use to measure in that are very solid. But it's not just the US State Department either. It's like there's a Council of Europe GRETA committee that have identified the same things. The Irish government, or sorry, the Irish courts have said the same things as well. So all the things that we're doing wrong,
identified
numerous different places. And so the fact that we are so delayed and so bureaucratic and so slow in identifying somebody as being a victim of trafficking. You know, for example, if you're an asylum seeker, you're not allowed to be identified as a victim of trafficking, which makes no sense. They kind of say to them, you have to be one or the other. You either keep your asylum claim going or you're identified as a victim of trafficking. You can't be both. And that doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't match what happens internationally for a start. But it also saying you can't be an EU national and be a victim of trafficking, which again doesn't tally with the reality of trafficking either. When you talked about forced marriages earlier on, that generally was women from Eastern Europe that were trafficked to Ireland to engage in marriages here in Ireland so the person could avail of the immigration rights that would come from it. They're victims of trafficking, but they're not identified in Ireland. They're left out of the process, you know. So identification is huge. Then accommodation is the other one. So at the moment, Ireland puts victims of trafficking that are either suspected or identified into direct provision, which is just when you think about it on a very basic level. So what we're doing is putting victims of crime or people who are identified as potential victims of crime into the direct provision system, which everybody recognizes is generally not fit for purpose. And everybody recognizes that in this particular circumstance as well, when you're dealing with somebody who's got triers of organized crime controlling them, direct provision is not the place for them, you know? So identification, accommodation, they're two big things. The third thing is the fact that we've never once, not since 2013, since the legislation was updated, convicted a trafficker. So we've never convicted a trafficker in Ireland. And that's been identified as being a massive problem as well. And the other thing, the fourth point is just general overall government buy-in to the concept. You know, it's been recommended that we need a rapporteur in Ireland to look at trafficking, to look at the government responses from all the different areas, from the health, from the guards, from the courts, from the DPP, and tie it all together. So overall coordination of our response, which we're lacking in Ireland as well. All these things are fixable. So I can go into solutions if you want, or I'm conscious that I might be talking too much.
Can I just ask, Brian, you've said nobody has been convicted. So if there's no deterrent, how can we say that the situation is going to improve in any way? And I can understand from a wider point of view, people want to see a deterrent to this, absolutely want to see a deterrent. So why don't we have it?
The guards will argue that they get trafficked on lesser offences. They say things like, trafficking is the highest bar that we can get somebody on. But we do get traffickers on money laundering. We do get traffickers on immigration offences, things like that, lesser offences. But the guards would argue that, at least we're getting them on something, essentially, you know. So there's a bit of a deterrence in that. But as you say, the message gets out very clearly that Ireland is, that connection has never been made. And if you are in organized crime and you're a trafficker and you know that, and you know that that's the landscape in the country, that's a massive pull factor. So it gets back to your question earlier on about why is Ireland somewhere that traffickers are interested in? And that we would argue that the fact that there's been no convictions for trafficking is a serious point, is a real pull factor in that regard. You know, it makes it a very appealing landscape for somebody to engage in this kind of stuff in. So that is a massive problem, and it suggests that there's a breakdown in understanding of how to deal with this between the guards, between the courts, and between the DPP. So the guards will propose something to the DPP and say, we think this is trafficking, and the DPP will say, no, I don't think that's trafficking, and they'll go and they'll get them on the lesser offences, like I said earlier. But there's something going on in that conversation that needs to be sorted out, whereby it doesn't seem to be crossing the threshold into actually convicting somebody of trafficking, you know. And it is a difficult area. Like, it's an international crime. Gangs frequently move in and out of the country. They move people in and out of the country as well to avoid detection. It involves Europol and Interpol. You know, they're not easy things to get convictions in, but still something is broken. There's still something broken in our response that means we're not getting those convictions.
I know this, it's so hard to move off the topic, but we only have a limited time, and I just want to bring up the fact that you've mentioned direct provision a few times. We've seen in a program for government the commitment to ending direct provision for the first time, instead of the every time they talked about it. First of all, we were told, you know, Usher, it's okay, then it's okay. Well, it needs a few tweaks. And then that dreaded word reform came up several times. You know, we're going to reform it. And now there's a commitment there. Do you think it's significant that, first of all, that it's been moved into the Minister for Disability, Children and Equality and Integration, into that department, as opposed to, you know, the Justice Department? Was that a positive development?
I think it was always an anomaly to a certain extent that Justice were doing housing. Like, you know, I think a lot of the time people never took a step back and said, why are the Department of Justice doing housing? Why is they don't do housing? That's not their gig. You know, they were landed with direct provision, you know, 20 years ago, or dreamt it up themselves, essentially. And the fact that it's been in with them all that time has been an anomaly. Like, why is it not part of overall housing? Why is it siloed away? And a lot of the responses to trying to move past direct provision in the last few years have been centered around the fact, well, we have a housing crisis, so we can't change direct provision. That's been the political response over and over and over again. And that only, for us, it kind of draws attention to the fact that, well, why is direct provision taken as being separate from overall housing? And why are we treating asylum seekers differently and institutionalizing them in this way? So I think the fact that it's moved out of the Department of Justice into this new department definitely gives hope. You know, it definitely gives a new opportunity to look at it from a fresh perspective. With the mandate of the program for government behind it saying that we're going to end direct provision, you know. I think institutionally in the Department of Justice, back in the 2000s when direct provision was set up, it was kind of a short-term response that became a long-term policy. And a lot of it was around deterrence. A lot of it was around kind of, we don't want to make it too good to apply for asylum in Ireland, you know, and that would never be said officially, and that would never necessarily be said publicly. But that was part, I think, of the Department of Justice's approach back in the day of, we need to be able to control this area. We need to keep it with us. We need to keep it here. And we need to make sure that it's not like an easy access to housing in Ireland to stop people coming, essentially. You know, it was fear of being overrun by numbers. Now, I think things have changed in the Department of Justice in the last few years, that there's some people gone in there that are coming at it from a different mindset. And there has been a transformation process in there that I think has informed their thinking, you know. So it's not all bad in terms of the thinking in the Department of Justice about direct provision. There are, you know, glimmers of hope, and there have been in the last few years about changing their approach to it. But the fact that it's moved out now and it's gone into a new government department, a lot will be seen as to how that actually plays out. But I think the Rubicon has been crossed in direct provision, where now it's become the political narrative that it has to be done away with, you know. And that was resisted for the last 20 years, like again and again and again and again. And I think it's another case of the government being behind the public again, like marriage equality, like repeal the eighth. The public led the way, and eventually politics caught up with it and said, okay, yeah, maybe that is something we need to sort out, you know. And I think, you know, the groundswell that's gone on in the last while, listening to the voices of young people in direct who've gone through direct provision, the racism they experience as being part of it, this isolation, the segregation that they experience as being part of it, that's part of the narrative now. That's part of the media. It's out there now, and more so even in the last 2 or 3 months because of Black Lives Matter. So I think the Rubicon has been crossed, it's now seen as being something that needs to be done away with, not reformed, you know. You can't firefight this forever and ever and ever. It needs to be a new approach. And hopefully it'll get to the situation where we can look back at it and say, that's a policy that's gone, you know.
Brian, has the COVID-19 outbreak, has that affected things in any way, slowed it, made it worse, or have you yet to feel the effects of that?
In terms of the process of changing it, do you mean?
Trafficking too. You know, less movement of people. Has it improved the situation to have less movement of people?
Well, one of the things that happened during COVID, and it's probably not widely known, is that for about 3 months we didn't have an immigration system. there was no people coming to Ireland. There was no visas processed. Everything was put on hold, essentially, you know. And also even just the immigration authorities process and applications just stopped for about 3 months as well. And that's starting back up again now. So I think overall, like when the immigration system itself ground to a halt, it would be, you know, likely that it will have a knock on impact on things like trafficking, because, you know, student visas won't be processed, all that kind of stuff won't happen, you know. And when it comes to direct provision, I think what COVID-19 highlighted is the fact that in that institutional setting is the worst kind of place to respond to something like COVID-19. It's impossible to social distance. It's impossible to have any privacy. It just highlighted the complete lack of that. So in some ways, I think, even though it's a terrible circumstance, COVID-19 again highlighted the fact that direct provision is not a suitable place for people to be in, because you can't look after them in those kind of circumstances, you know? So I think it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. But as I said, I think that the general narrative around direct provision has changed. But the fact that we're going to go into a recession again, probably in the next while, will be a risk, you know, that will come from COVID-19 as well. So the fact that we're in recession could be rolled out again politically has been a reason why we can't reform a system, why we can't move beyond direct provision. We can't fix the housing crisis, so how are we going to fix direct provision, you know? But we really do need to think much more creatively about housing in Ireland, and direct provision is part of that.
There is a solution to that, Brian, and it's not just about moving it to, you know, the Department of Equality. It's about engaging with the likes of the Land Development Agency and making housing for immigrants part of that remit as well. I mean, we have the capacity, in terms of land, we have available land banks to cover all of our housing needs. It's just the delivery methods. And, you know, I'd be interested, I spoke to Dara O'Brien, the new housing minister, a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, and it's always interesting that there's two topics that seldom come up when you talk to housing. It's for people in direct provision are never mentioned, and people with disabilities are seldom mentioned. And, you know, these are the sort of things that we need to think a bit broader about. I suppose just if it was, so we're saying, you know, the minister now has committed to a white paper by the end of this year, in terms of direct provision. You know, I'm assuming they'll be talking to, you know, people who are on the ground, people who understand the needs and understand what needs to be met. You know, are there any things that we think we should be all looking out for, or things that we need to see in that, in terms of, you know, that key points that we all should be conscious of, that we hope that it'll actually mean that this will be the time that this thing changes, and not just be, you know, more a review, a white paper followed by an inquiry followed by an X and a da 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 da, da and a,
you know, and a report. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I think one thing people need to do is absolutely maintain pressure on their local political representatives about direct provision, because, you know, the parish pump politics is not gone out of Ireland at all. And if their local constituents are saying to them through the constituency office that we want direct provision, we want you to stand over that commitment in the programme for government, and we want it gone, and they're doing that repeatedly, that will keep it up the political agenda, because at the end of the day, that is what they respond to. They respond to who's approaching them through their political offices. And if it's not seen as an issue of public need, it'll drop down the agenda again and again, you know. So I'd appeal to anybody, get on to your local political representative. If you do it once, brilliant. If you can do it a number of times, better again. Make sure that they know that this is an issue that the public wants to see resolved, and try and keep it up the political agenda. I think, you know, when they said they were coming out with a white paper by the end of the year, you go, okay, another white paper. It's almost like this conversation has been had 100 times over the last 20 years as to what needs to be done to direct provision. So you kind of, you know, your heart sinks a little bit to a certain extent, but they have to go through the procedures of government to do it. And a white paper is a good way to do that. And in some ways it informs the choices that they make, say in 2021 and 2022, what they're going to budget for, you know? So at the end of the day, with government as well, it comes down to money. So what they invest in direct provision every year is over 100 million every year. You know, it's a huge, hugely expensive system. What kind of choices will they make come to the budget next year for 2021 about allocational model entirely, or will they be putting a section of their budget around direct provision towards investing in approved housing bodies, for example, so that the likes of housing providers that can be funded to provide some of their accommodation for direct provision. And they can do things like prioritizing families in direct provision, get kids out of direct provision. Let's go with them first. You know, what kind of choices are they making coming towards the end of the year and like that? And how is 2021 going to look like, you know? So I think maintaining political pressure is one thing that everybody could play a part in doing that. And the other is then watching, you know, as this evolves, what kind of choices are the government making in terms of budget allocations and things like that. And we would hope that you know, they will engage. And I think they will with, like, MASI, you know, the movement of asylum seekers. They need to be engaged, as they always have been, but continue to be engaged. The likes of the Refugee Council have done great work on alternative direct provision. They need to be around the table, you know. So there needs to be, you know, the follow-on needs to be very, very secure and very, very thorough. And it needs to be about hardcore choices, like what kind of budget allocations are you making, you know.
We have got a program that we say in Ireland we run, and it's been successful in other countries, particularly in Scandinavia. It's called Housing First. And if Housing First means, you know, and if you truly believe in equality, you know, Housing First means housing for everyone. And the likes of that, we have it as a, Martin, we're sick of the idea of these tests where they, you know, we're running a test program to see how it works. But something like Housing First, that gives people, and again, it's not about saying that every person who arrives off the boat gets a free house. I mean, none of that nonsense rhetoric, that crap.
Yeah.
It's about people being able to get avail of adequate housing and a progressive right to housing. So it's, you know, making sure that we're doing that and including people who are coming to this country. We've spoken to doctors who travel to meet some of the people you spoke about who are trafficked, you know, and they've gone through traumas we'd never dream of. And, you know, and these doctors aren't by the state, by the way, the likes of Austin O'Carroll's Safety Net team that go out there and talk to some of these people, and we need to look at it from those perspectives. Very, very, very last thing for me, Brian, is if people want to help you guys out, how can they do that?
Yeah, much appreciated. I suppose that, as I said at the start, some people think we're a state body, and we're not. We're a non-governmental organization. We're independent, and that independence is important to us, you know, so we can advocate against the state in certain instances, like go to the High Court. We can agitate, and we'll sit around the table with them at the same time and go, all right. If they go on our website as well, any support that people can give us as an organization is hugely appreciated, you know. Essentially, like, it translates directly into, if we can fund our legal services to have a solicitor, they can provide legal representation to somebody who wouldn't get it otherwise, you know. So it goes directly into that. We're a bare bones organization in that regard. So they can get us on immigrantcouncil.ie is our website, and just look us up on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us there as well. So yeah, much appreciated for having the opportunity to chat about these issues.
Thanks so much for coming on and having a chat with us, Brian. It's great to have a chat with you, and thanks for all the work that you do. Just like to remind listeners, just like Brian, we are an NGO, and we do our best here in the Tortoise Shack. So please sign up as a patron to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Helps keep the show on the road. Brian, thank you again for your time this morning.